traumatic accident. We and everything around us are merely the byproducts of a chance convergence of cosmic biochemical processes. We are just congealed stardust, and when we die, we return to the meaningless oblivion from which we came. Now, if that's how you think of yourself, why not put the pleasure principle at the center of your life? If that's all there is, why leave the sandbox of self-infatuation? If that's all there can be, why sacrifice for someone else? In an easy-to-grasp way that is nevertheless rooted on some very deep thought, Unrepeatable offers an alternative to this degrading vision of human nature and human possibility, and thus fleshes out, for our confused cultural moment, what it means to grow into the more excellent way that St. Paul proposed to those cantankerous Corinthians 2 millennia ago. As his biographer, I am frequently asked why St. John Paul II was such a magnetic Pied Piper for the young. My constant answer is that he was a compelling figure because he told the truth, and he challenged the young to live in the truth. He didn't hedge, and he didn't pander. He knew that all of us fail, but he also knew that failure is no reason for young people to lower the bar of expectation or to lower their standards. Above all, he knew from his own experience as a university chaplain that young people want to lead lives of heroism, lives that count. So do Luke Burgess and Joshua Miller, and that knowledge permeates and informs this book. Civilization itself depends on a critical mass of men and women who live vocationally, who live for others, because they live according to the call to nobility and excellence that resonates in every human heart. Unrepeatable helps chart a path toward a better future than that proposed by the culture of me, and does so one life at a time. George Weigel, Distinguished Senior Fellow and William E. Simon Chair in Catholic Studies, Ethics, and Public Policy Center. Introduction. You lose yourself. You reappear. You suddenly find you got nothing to fear. Alone you stand with nobody near, when a trembling distant voice unclear startles your sleeping ears to hear that somebody thinks they really found you. Bob Dylan. It's all right, Ma. I'm only bleeding. It was May 17, 1966. Bob Dylan was playing to a crowd of about 2,000 at the Free Trade Hall in Manchester, England. With his acoustic guitar slung over his shoulder and a wooden harmonica strapped to his neck, he warble-crooned his way through tracks from his new album, Blonde on Blonde, released the day before. In Visions of Johanna, he sang the words, "The ghost of electricity howls in the bones of her face." It was an ominous line. On this world tour, Dylan had been shaking up fans by switching to an electric guitar for his second set, a shocking departure from his folk music roots. The fans in Manchester heard the news, but many of them didn't want to believe it. Dylan closed his first set with "Mr. Tambourine Man," bowed, and walked off the stage. The audience was edgy. After the intermission, Dylan strutted back out. He had his band, the Hawks, with him, and a 65 black Fender Stratocaster electric guitar with a maple cap neck slung on his shoulder. Bassist Rick Danko plugged a Fender Jazz bass into an amplifier. Guitarist Robbie Robinson smashed into a riff for "Tell Me Mama." The sound system in the hall wasn't made for the raw, visceral power of the music. Fan C.P. Lee said it felt like I was being forced back in my seat, like being in a jet when it takes off. Dylan raised the volume of his voice to match the intensity of his band. Between songs, he paced the stage in silence, tuning his guitar and mumbling in a raspy voice. Caterwauls of protest broke out in the audience. Fans started squabbling. Dylan charged forward, playing song after song of high decibel rock. Just like Tom Thumb's